anyway. All right, let's take our Bibles and let's turn to the Gospel of Luke. Luke chapter 7. And we'll be looking at the first of two miracles. The one tonight is not unique to Luke. In other words, there's an account of it in the Gospel of Matthew. But next week, we'll look at the second one, which is unique to Luke's Gospel. But more on that in another time. But Luke chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. Faith believes in the words of Jesus, would be one way to think of this. And so we'll be looking at that. Now, if you did want to read ahead for next week, all you'll need to do is pick up in verse 11 and read through verse 17, and you'll have the second miracle. So tonight we'll look at verses 1 through 10, and then we'll look at next week 11 through 17. 11 through 17 is a unique one to Luke, meaning it's one of the miracles that is just that. It's unique to Luke's gospel. But when we think about the miracles of Jesus, they teach us a lot of spiritual lessons, obviously, but they also help us to understand who Jesus is better. The primary purpose of the miracles is actually not for us in terms of spiritual lessons. Those are subsequent to it. They largely teach and they show certain traits or attributes of Jesus. John probably shows that the best, but in any case, when we look at this particular miracle tonight, I just want you to think about this. Which is, and I want you to consider this, is do you believe that Jesus has to be present physically to heal?
No.
Can Jesus simply speak the word and it come forth? Okay. Yep. So just have that in your mind as we go through this, because again, one of the misfortunes with the miracles is sometimes we focus too much on ourselves with us instead of what they teach about the Lord Jesus. And both are true. There's a lot of good spiritual lessons in these miracles, but I want us to do a little bit of both. Look at what they have to teach about Jesus. And that's what we'll be looking at tonight, of course, next week as well. But if you want the outline, what we'll do is we'll look at verse 1, and I'll use that to teach on and remind us of the setting. So we'll look at verse 1, we'll read it, and then we'll look at the setting of the miracle, because the setting of the miracle isn't extremely important, but important enough that I want to explain where it fits in Jesus' ministry, because it does have some bearing in it. And then we'll look at verses 2 through 5 of Luke 7. A centurion's servant. We'll learn about this servant, of this centurion, who is sick and at the point of death. So that's verses 2 through 5. And then we'll look at, I would just call it the miracle proper. In other words, verses 6 through 10, power over distance. Because Jesus is essentially going to finish a teaching that he's done recently. He's going to return to Capernaum. He's going to find out that this centurion has a need or a request from Jesus to heal his beloved servant. Jesus is going to not even physically go there, but yet the servant is healed when they arrive there. So that's the general flow of the story. I'll read verse 1 because I'm going to use verse 1 to describe the setting of it. And there's a particular teaching that precedes it. And the placing of this miracle is interesting and it's always been fascinating to me. But let me read verse 1. And then I'll have two readers later for verses 2 through 5 and 6 through 10. But let's look at verse 1 first. So chapter 7 of Luke, verse 1. When he had completed all his discourse in the hearing of the people, he went to Capernaum. All right, so let's get the basics of where Jesus is at. So essentially, this takes place in the period of Jesus' ministry that's called the Great Galilean Ministry. That's just sort of a way of trying to figure out when during his life certain events happen. And if you study the life of Jesus, that's what you'll find is that these events that we're looking at this week and next week fall into what's called his Great Galilean Ministry. You say, well, what in the world does that mean? Well, beyond the obvious, most of Jesus's ministry is in Galilee, not all of it. But this is where you might say he's sort of at his peak, I would say. And what typically is meant by that is there's not a lot of opposition. There is some, but not a lot. He's doing a lot of ministry in Galilee. And he hasn't quite yet begun to shift to where it's the idea of his suffering and crucifixion. Okay, so that's just a time period. It's just sort of what it's called and some of the different events that happened in his life. Now, I want you to look at what precedes it. You say, well, what do you mean? Well, look in verse chapter 6, and what you'll find is, and I'll show you this a little bit here, and we won't. I'm not going to digress on this too much and get us off track, but look at Luke 6. Of course, that's what precedes it. Hopefully, because if not, you're in trouble. You need to get you a new Bible. But in all kidding aside, so essentially what happens is Jesus chooses the 12 disciples. That's what you see in verses 12 through 16. But then notice it says Jesus comes down and he stands on the level plain. And then in verse 20, he begins to teach, blessed are the poor. You probably recognize that. This is, and I'm going to explain this just in brief because I don't want to get us too far off the beaten path here. So the miracle takes place at the end of what we think of as the Sermon on the Mount, okay? I'll just explain this in brief terms. It doesn't really relate to this too much, but just so you have an idea in case you run across this. The Sermon on the Mount proper is Matthew 5 through 7. Luke has a recording of it or rendering an account of it, and we see that if you want to read it sometime, picks up in verse 20 and it goes through verse 49 of Luke 6. Now, some suggest that this is either an abridged version of the full one. The full one is the one you know from Matthew 5 through 7. Some suggest it's a abridged version. Others call it the Sermon on the Plain. If you have a MacArthur Study Bible, he has a really good synopsis of this. It doesn't really play into what we're talking about here, but just so if you ever encounter it, Matthew is the full version of the Sermon on the Mount. Luke either has an abridged version or it's a shortened version because Jesus taught it at another time. And you say, why would Jesus do that? Well, pastors do that all the time. Okay. And that's the idea. So don't get too sidetracked on that, but that's the main point there. But what I want you to notice is that Jesus finishes, and for purposes of simplicity, he finishes this discourse, the Sermon on the Mount as we know it. But I want someone to read for me verses 46 through 49 in just a moment. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, whether it's Matthew's or Luke's, so whether an abridged version, full version, or a shortened, whatever you want to call it, version, they both end the same way, meaning the Sermon on the Mount ends the same way. The importance of the Sermon on the Mount is very simply this. Jesus sort of concludes. He's wrapping up the Sermon on the Mount, and he says, there's two types of people. There are those who will hear my words, believe, and live their lives based on my words, or the other category, they'll reject my words, and they won't. Okay, and this sets the stage a little bit for what we're going to see with the centurion. So someone read verses 46 through 49 for me, if you would.
It's chapter 6.
Yeah, if you don't mind.
Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? Everyone who comes to me and hears my words and acts it, and immediately it collapsed, and the ruin of that house was great.
All right, thank you, Gene. So pretty straightforward, right, for our purposes. Two types of people. Sorry, there's not a third one, but there's two types. You either hear the words of Jesus, if you think about the ending of the Sermon on the Mount, and you live them out. You decide you're going to live your life based on the authority of Jesus' words, or you're not. In Matthew's account, the people are amazed that he taught the way that he did, but that his words, if you read it, had what? Authority to them. Okay? So just have that in the back of your mind, because when we encounter this centurion, the centurion is going to be set in contrast to the Jewish believers of the day, as a generalization, because one will believe Jesus' words so much that Jesus doesn't even have to be physically present. Jesus can simply speak the words, and his words are so authoritative and so strong. All Jesus has to do is speak, and it is, in a sense, okay? Now, if you notice as well the setting, we see sort of where we are. This is really a little bit more so for next week. But you'll notice that Jesus, of course, so he finishes the Sermon on the Mount, which is in the region of Galilee, there on the Sea of Galilee, that general area. And then he goes to Capernaum, which is his, I call it his headquarters. That's essentially what it's typically called. You see that in Matthew 4:13. All that to say, Jesus has finished teaching the Sermon on the Mount. He leaves, he makes his way to Capernaum, and then he's going to be introduced to, and there's this scene change, and this centurion is going to come, who is this prominent figure, and he's going to approach Jesus. But what you're going to find is a contrast. The elders of the day, the Jewish leaders, are going to be in contrast to this centurion, who is a Gentile. And this Gentile is going to be a little unusual for a Roman, if we will, soldier or captain of the army, we might think of. So someone read verses 2 through 5, and we're going to be encountering this centurion's servant who has a problem, and the centurion goes to Jesus, and we'll deal more with that later. But verses 2 through 5, would someone read those for me?
I'll do it. 2 through 5?
Yes. 7. Yep.
And a centurion slave who was highly regarded by him was sick and about to die. And it was he who built us our synagogue.
All right. So we move in here. So the scene changes, if you will. If you think of these as sort of like a play or whatever, if it helps you visualize it, Jesus finishes his Sermon on the Mount. He makes his way to Capernaum, where the headquarters typically is thought of there. But then we're sort of introduced to something a little bit different, which is a centurion. Anybody know what a centurion is? Well, it's a non... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Soldier.
Yeah. So it's a non-commissioned officer who had at least, guess how many people? You know how I remember that?
Century.
Yeah. So think about it. That's not complicated. That's the easy way to remember it, is that. So hence a century, a centurion. But one of the things that you need to notice here, Luke is really good with this, which is typical for him. Luke shows that this soldier, we'll just say for simplicity terms, this Roman soldier, he's a little bit unique, isn't he? Roman soldiers, you don't typically think of them as humble, compassionate, and merciful, do you? As a general rule, you think of them with the big soldiers' weaponry and the weapons and so forth. So he's very different. I'm going to read you something here. It comes from the Wycliffe Bible Commentary that Moody puts out. It says, "The centurions were the backbone of the Roman army. Usually they came up from the ranks to post of command because of their character. This officer seems to have been different from the usual hard type of Roman military man. He had a genuine affection for his servant, and he loved the Jewish nation, which most of the Romans despised." I mention that to you because, again, what Luke is doing here is he's picturing essentially two types of people. This centurion, who is a Gentile, which is very unusual, and he's going to put them up against, of course, these Jewish elders and these leaders. So the centurion here, this man of obvious prominence and prestige and those sorts of things. In other words, he has a place of authority, doesn't he? I mean, obviously, he's going to say so later. But a couple of things that you'll see here is that he has this servant. And this servant, of course, of his is sick. If you look at the account, you don't need to turn here, in Matthew 8:6, it gives the idea that he has some sort of paralytic, or whether it be partial or full, this mobility problem that he has. But what I want you to see in Luke's account is actually in verse 7. I know we haven't read this yet, but it's important. So he's got this servant of his, it would be unusual to really care. They're dime a dozen. I hate to use our vernacular today, but he isn't that way. But he has this servant. He's either partially or fully paralyzed. We don't know the particular situation. But what I want you to notice is something, and we miss this in English a little bit, but in verse 7 of Luke 7, he says at the end, you speaking, he says, "But just say the word and my servant will be healed." In Greek, it's called pious, and it means son or boy. Now, let's read it again. So the centurion, we'll get to this in a minute. I just want you to see something. I'm trying to emphasize something here. He says, my son or my child or my boy needs to be healed. Now, obviously, that shows that he has this deep affection and this love for his servant. And he has this unusual compassion for him. And he's concerned, so he sends this request to Jesus, and he says to him that his son, or servant, excuse me, is about to die. And so he has this sick servant. He has this deep love for him. In verse 7, when we read it, just think of this affection. He sees him almost like a son. Do you understand? A son versus a soldier. The soldier is like his son, is what the Greek text teaches here. And so he sends this request to Jesus. Now you're thinking, what's the big emphasis here? Jesus isn't there yet. Jesus isn't physically there. And the story gets developed over time. Jesus isn't present. Okay? And so it's important to remember that his servant is sick at his house, for simplicity. Jesus isn't there, and he needs to be healed. And if he doesn't hurry up and do it, he's going to die. Now, the Jewish elders are kind of interesting, and this is in verse 3. So in Luke chapter 7 and verse 3, when it was read earlier, the centurion, he hears about Jesus, and he sends some Jewish leaders, these elders. And it's kind of interesting because, again, you have to think about the context. Usually the Roman soldiers and the Jews and the synagogues and all these officials, they usually bickered and butted heads. And so it's a little bit of an unusual situation. And so he sends these individuals. They're sort of like intercessors, if you think of it this way, representatives. A loose analogy to that would be this. Does the president of the United States usually and always go somewhere? Or does he sometimes send the secretary of state to represent him? Of course, it's the latter. It's a loose analogy, but get the idea that the centurion sends these Jewish elders, which is unusual, but clearly they respected this man, and we're going to see that. But notice their evaluation of this, which until we read the rest of these verses 6 through 10, it doesn't really mean too much. But notice when it was read, and I'm going to read it again for emphasis because Luke's going to draw this out in the next set of verses. Notice what it says. In verse 4, when they came to Jesus, so Jesus isn't present. I'm repeating this for a purpose later. And they go and they implore Jesus, saying, "He is worthy for you to grant this request." Note this in your notes, and we'll return to it later. They estimate that the centurion is worthy. He has worth, and he's worthy of Jesus answering it. We're going to return back to it later. But notice the basis for what they deem as his worth. Well, he loves the nation and he's built a synagogue, meaning the local synagogue. Now, if you don't know what a synagogue is or get confused, a simple way to think of it is you have the temple. The temple was destroyed when the Babylonians came in. And as they dispersed, they in towns would put these synagogues up. The synagogues are still around. They're still around in the time of Paul. And the temple, of course, gets eventually rebuilt. But I'm going to read you this if you don't know, just so you don't get confused with a synagogue versus a temple. The Ryrie Study Bible explains it clearly. It says that a synagogue was a Jewish house of worship first established during the Babylonian captivity, but also used after the temple was rebuilt by the Jews. Wherever they settled, services, meaning in a synagogue, Ryrie says, included prescribed readings, prayer, and then a sermon. Now, before we move on to what I call the miracle proper in verses 6 through 10, the elders of the day are not really too different than people today. A person's worth before the Lord was based off of what they did and what their achievements were. I thought of this, and I don't want to confuse you a little bit, but turn real quick. We're not going to spend very long here. I'll just encourage you to read it at another time. It's Philippians 3. I'm not going to spend too much, but it's Paul's resume is what I call it, his credentials before Christ, and then he gives an evaluation of them after he came to Christ. And just for brevity purposes, but this is Philippians 3. I encourage you to read it on your own and just sort of mull over it, but it's simply this. If you want to read it on your own, chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, it is Paul's resume. It's his credentials before he came to Christ. It would be a good picture of what the Jews would have seen as successful or as worthy. And you'll notice all of these things are, if you will, things we probably would say on the one hand, they're certainly not wrong, but then we're going to see the differences. And you can just see these, for example, in verse 4, although I myself have confidence in the flesh. Notice verse 5, these credentials, his resume before Christ. He said, I was circumcised on the eighth day. I was of the nation of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin. I mean, if there was a Hebrew, I was the Hebrew of them all. He says, to the law, I was a Pharisee. In other words, I'm a stickler to the law. Zeal, I was a persecutor of church, meaning I went after that which I thought was against God. And so forth. He says, as to righteousness, which is found in the law, I was blameless. That would be a typical Jewish thought. Okay. I find my worth based on what I do and who I am before God. It's sort of this idea of, and we do the same thing today, how can I earn God's favor? But notice what changes in Paul. And I'll tell you to go back and read this on your own and just reflect on it. Verses 7 through 11 show how after he came to Christ, everything changed. His evaluation on those things changed. Notice what he says. But whatever things were gained to me, those things I have counted as loss for the sake of Christ. More than that, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing worth of knowing Jesus Christ, my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and count them but rubbish so that I might gain Christ. You can read the rest. Essentially what it does is, and I think it gives a picture of the Jewish mindset of Jesus' day. Before I come to Christ, I find my worth in all of the things of this world, all of my credentials. They're not necessarily bad, but my standing before God, my worth before God is what I do. You know people like that? They want to earn God's favor. But then when they come to Christ, they realize all of those things are worthless and I can't earn God's favor. But what you're going to find in the miracle, so let's turn back now to Luke chapter 7, and we're going to look at reading verses 6 through 10. The scene moves, if you will, to where Jesus has been approached. The servant is still at a distance. In other words, you think of the centurion's home, if that helps you make it simpler. And the centurion is going to describe himself differently than the Jewish elders. Someone read verses 6 through 10, and you'll see the difference between the two. Someone want to read those for me? Go ahead, Linda. Thank you.
Great faith. When those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health.
All right. Thank you, Linda. So I call it the scene moves on, right? So Jesus finishes the Sermon on the Mount. He makes his way back to his headquarters at Capernaum. He's approached by this Gentile, this centurion, who has this servant whom he loves, and he's been using the Jewish elders, and the elders' evaluation is that the centurion is worthy because of what he's done. Now, when you pick up in verse 6 when Linda was reading, so Jesus starts on his way. And if you want to look in a Bible map, all you have to do is find the Sea of Galilee, and it would be to the west area there. This is all in that general area. Next week, I'll look at the exact city where he goes to next. But notice when it was being read, when he was not far from the house. So there's this emphasis by Luke to make sure you remember, Jesus was never present. So whatever happens, Jesus never physically arrived at this place prior to the healing here. And so there is this distance. That's why I call it power over distance, because you could also say it. I didn't want to use the word presence because that gives a misunderstanding of it. But the idea that we're going to see is the question is, does Jesus have to be physically present, or can his words be so authoritative and powerful that he can bring forth what he wills? Of course, you know which way it's going to go. But let's look here, though, at something, and I want to draw this out a little bit. So when he comes, and notice what the response is. This is in verse 6. Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not what?
Worthy.
So the Jewish leaders of the day picture what? My worth is in, or a person's worth before God and before the Lord, if you want to put it that way, is based off of what he's done. And many people are like that, right? Lord, I sung in the choir for 112 years. I gave every week except for that week that I didn't get paid. I taught Bible studies. I listened to Pastor Pace's podcast. You know what I'm saying? And we do that all the time. Baptism, I was baptized. I mean, I even took communion once, I think. Surely God must be pleased with me, and my standing before him is based off of what I do. Now, isn't it interesting that a Gentile who is humble says he's not worthy? This is the emphasis of it here, is this humility. Now, when we think of humility, I think you can go to an extreme on it where you begin to self-depreciate yourself. Okay? That's not humility. Okay? And the reason why I say that is if you ever wanted to give someone evidence that they have value, teach them the Word of God, because every single person was created and born in the image of God. And the very definition of that means that they have value in God's eyes. Sinner, the deeds redeemed, sure, marred, but not destroyed. You know, so remember that. To come to the point where you know that you have humility is when you recognize, I know who I am before God. I'm a sinner. I can't save myself, but he can. Okay? So don't go down this track of false humility, which is this degrading of yourself. You have value before God. Okay? You just are separated because of your sin until you come to Christ. Now, moving on, the centurion has two things that he emphasizes. They're sort of one in the same. So when it says in verse 6, he says, look, you're not even, Jesus, I'm not even worthy for you to be in my presence. Okay? Verse 7, for this reason, I don't even consider myself worthy, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. But notice verse 8, and you can see where as a centurion, as a captain, if you will, if it makes you understand, a general of an army, what is his analogy to it? He says, look, I'm sort of like a commander in an army, and I have men, and where are the men? Well, they could be anywhere, right? Where do the men are? The men are not always in his presence, are they? The soldiers could be anywhere. You think of that today in any sort of warfare. A soldier or general gives orders, and those orders may be for something that is far off. He doesn't have to be present. And he says that I have such authority in my words because I'm the commander of the soldiers that when they hear my words, they just do it. It's just this immediate obedience. And he says, Jesus, you're sort of like that in a way. He is sort of analogous to it. He says, Jesus, when you speak a word, you don't even have to be there because your words are so authoritative and so powerful. It just is. Now, let me ask, in the account of creation, what happens? God spoke. God spoke. And God spoke, and it just was. It's sort of the idea of where this goes. Luke doesn't emphasize that quite as much as some of the accounts with John. But that's what I want you to see, is that the centurion, he knew that he had Roman authority. And when he spoke, the soldiers did what he said, whether he was there or not. And he says, Jesus, you're the same. You don't even have to come. All you have to do is speak and my servant will be healed. Now, what is that called? Faith. I mean, is that not faith? I mean, I've known people that would probably say, Jesus, you got to come to the house, lay hands on you. No, Jesus just simply says the word and he'll believe. Now, notice Jesus's response, though, in verse 9. Now, when Jesus heard this, he marveled at him. Jesus doesn't marvel at hardly anything in all of the four Gospels, and I've read them backwards and forwards, inside and out. Jesus marvels only a few times. Typically, though, it is at the unbelief of the Israelites. He just cannot believe. They don't believe because he dots all of the I's and crosses all of the T's of the Messiah. But the Gentiles, for some reason, he's marveled that how could they believe? They're not even Jewish. So he marvels at them, or at the man, and he says, not even in Israel have I found such faith. So what's he doing? Simple. The Gentiles are pictured as being welcoming and receiving, whereas the nation of Israel had all of the promises and blessings, and they just can't believe, can they? They can't get past themselves. And so what happens in the story is pretty simple. Notice, so Jesus says, look, you just don't even see this in Israel, my people. But then in verse 10, when those who had been sent returned to the house, they find him healed. Jesus healed, and if you read the account in Matthew, it gives this idea that when the time of the healing occurred was probably about the same time, roughly, as when Jesus spoke those words. The point is that when Jesus, I guess, willed or decided he was going to heal him, he didn't even have to go. And he didn't even need to do that. And so, like the centurion believed originally, when he sent the request, he had such faith in Jesus that all Jesus had to do was say the word and believed. And Jesus, of course, did, of course, give him and reward his faith. Now, why did I bring up the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain? Is it sometimes referred to as the abridged version? Because Jesus shows two types of people, doesn't he? What are the two types of people? They are the two types of people that either hear his words, they see him as authoritative, and they base all of their eternity off of him in their life. Or, on the other hand, they don't. One who believes Jesus' words perfectly or one who doesn't. And so you have to ask yourself, which one am I? Does Jesus have to be present, or can I simply take him at his word? I'm going to close with this verse. It's recorded later in Luke, and then I'll see if you have any comments or questions. It's Luke 11:28. And Jesus said, more than that, blessed are those who hear the word of God and keep it. So who is the blessed person? It's the one who hears the word of God, sets his life on it, builds his house, his foundation, in other words, his life on the words of God, because God's words don't fail. If you are like the man at the end of the Sermon on the Mount who puts trust in man's words, what happens when the storms come? Just washed away.